Quaker.com podcast. Today is podcast number 156. It is Monday, June 4th, 2012, and my name is Ben Stone. You know, last week, how do I even get into this? It was my intention this morning to continue on some of the theme that I was talking about last week with talking about the Old West, and I was going to finish up on some of the thoughts that I didn't really complete Friday with in discussions of the Old West and how it really wasn't a wild place with a lot of murder and robbery and all these things. Almost everything that people believe about the Old West is made up either by way of dime novels that were selling in the East at the time or by movies that came along later and glorified the violence and everything and, you know, made things out to be dramatically worse than they really were. I was going to go down that path today and finish up what I was talking about Friday, but, A interview has popped up on the internet over the weekend, and it's just so painful. I couldn't walk away and not talk about it at least a little bit. It really brings up some serious flaws in the entire libertarian movement, and it's some of the things actually that I've tried to talk about, you know, at least to this microphone for at least a year, but I've been really pushing this since I started to see it coming about around 2006 and 2007. And by 2008, I was making myself just obnoxious by screaming so much at libertarians saying, don't you see what's coming at you? Don't you see what's happening to the movement? It's this, we have to do something about this. And I was just making myself obnoxious by pushing this so hard. So, and I'm speaking in vague terms at this point, but let me go back to Selene's Law again. This is from Robert Anton Wilson and one of his characters in one of his novels named Selene. And there were three of Selene's laws, and I'm going to read the third of Selene's laws again. Number three, an honest politician is a national calamity. And the way this law works is that while a dishonest politician is interested only in bettering his own lot through abusing the public trust, an honest politician is far more dangerous since he is honestly interested in bettering society through political action. And that means writing and implementing more and more laws with good intentions and bad repercussions. And I always like to point out at this stage in the discussion, think of Bastiat. Think of everything that Bastiat taught. Think of how he emphasized the fact that it doesn't matter what the intentions of the politician are. When the laws are passed, if what you see appears to be good, or if the intention appears to be good, the odds are it's going to be calamitous. It's going to be a calamity. I don't know if calamitous is an actual word. But hey, this is America. We can make up our own words. Anyway, this was Bastiat's point, that whatever your intentions are, when you start creating a bunch of laws, the end consequence is almost always going to be worse than the situation you faced in the beginning. And that's the problem with an honest politician. They go into politics honestly believing they're going to do good. And I think the vast majority of politicians actually do this. They really think they're going to do good. But you can't use an evil force and the aggression that goes with that evil force to produce good. It's illogical. And that's the problem with government. It doesn't matter what your intentions are. In the long run, you're just going to make things worse. And this is why an honest politician is worse than a dishonest politician. If you think of a dishonest politician, hey, he can be bribed. you know, you can get him to do pretty much anything you want, and eventually he's going to get busted. Eventually his dishonesty is going to come to the surface, and you know, you'll see as he's filling his pockets. I think of somebody like, let's not go that direction. Let's just go back to my real point about honest politicians. So over the weekend, Robert Wenzel from the economicpolicyjournal.com, and this is a guy, Bob Wenzel is a very knowledgeable individual. He spoke recently at the Federal Reserve by invitation. They asked him to come to the Federal Reserve, and you should read the transcript of that. It was it's amazing what Bob told the Federal Reserve, the people at the Federal Reserve. Anyway, so Gary Johnson goes on. Gary Johnson, the Libertarian presidential candidate, goes on Robert Wenzel's podcast and does an interview with him, and that came out over the weekend. I think it actually came out Friday, but I didn't hear it until Saturday morning is when I heard it. And I was sitting at, we have in my house, we have two offices. One is my upstairs office that's strictly for badquaker.com. And then we have sort of a communal office for anybody in the household that needs to use a computer or whatever. We have a sort of a pile of desks in a sort of a horseshoe shape, and we have computers all attached all around it. So Saturday morning I was sitting at one of the computers at that desk complex, and my wife was sitting at a different one. I think she was probably playing a game or something or other. She was doing something, and I kicked on the podcast, the interview with Bob Wenzel interviewing Gary Johnson, and and my wife started laughing because she knew. She says, I think she said something to the effect of, "Well, you've got your podcast for Monday." because if I could use one sentence to describe Gary Johnson in this interview, I would say Gary Johnson was confused and directionless. And I'm not saying that because I dislike Gary Johnson. Every time that I've ever seen him speak or heard anything, you know, anything about him or whatever, it always seemed positive. I have nothing at all against Gary Johnson. He seems like a really nice guy, you know. It's just that if you're going to go on an interview with somebody like, you know, Bob Wenzel, who has a website called economicpolicyjournal.com, and he just recently spoke at the Federal Reserve, I'm thinking maybe you ought to, you know, brush up on your economics before you go on that interview with him, because he's probably going to ask you some economic questions. And I'll put a link on today's podcast to economicpolicyjournal.com's interview with Gary Johnson. And if you know, it's about half an hour long, and if you can stand the pain, oh man, it's worth listening to realize what a horrible condition the libertarian movement is in. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like a building that on the outside is all perfectly fine, but when you walk inside, you realize the thing is eaten up with termites, and it's about to collapse. That's what the libertarian, you know, that's what I've been saying since 2006. This is what we're facing with libertarianism. It has a rot from the inside, and unless we deal with that rot, it's all going to collapse all around us. And that's kind of one of the reasons why, you know, more and more people who in 2006, 2008, more and more people who at that time called themselves libertarian are now starting to pick other words, because, you know, we're on the verge of the entire libertarian movement becoming discredited. That's a radical thing to say when you consider the popularity of Ron Paul and the explosion of the liberty movement in the last, you know, 6 years, really, specifically in the last 4 years. For me to say that the libertarian movement is on the verge of collapsing at the same time that the liberty movement has exploded the way it has, I'm trying to draw a line here between the two, because everything that you've seen happen from Ron Paul in the last 4 years and all of the explosion of interest that's taken place in the liberty movement in the last 6 years, all of that happened separately from the existence of the Libertarian Party. The Libertarian Party and libertarianism as a whole has this internal rot in it. And I'm going to get into that. I'm going to get into that more in just a second. But I want to get back to Bob's interview with Gary Johnson. Oh man, like I said, if you can sit through it, go over there and listen to the interview for yourself. I'm not even going to talk about this about most of that interview because most of it was just so painful. Wow. But I do want to hit a couple points. Bob hits him with his very first question, how did you become a libertarian? And Gary Johnson's answer is that in 1971, he read a book called Here's What a Libertarian is All About. That's a direct quote from the interview. Gary Johnson says that in 71, he read this book called, he said someone gave him the book, and he said the name of it was Here's What a Libertarian is All About. I spent some time on Google attempting to find this book, and I've come to the conclusion that there is no book by that name. Either Gary Johnson is confused about the name, or what's most likely, I believe, is that it wasn't a book, it was a pamphlet. It was probably, if it was a book, it was probably self-published, and it was probably... probably more like a pamphlet. You know, in the early 70s, the libertarian movement didn't have a lot of money. And so a lot of people were self-publishing. They were, you know, getting small things printed up, whether that was in what might appear to be a book or whether it was in pamphlet form or whether it was in flyers or, you know, newsletters of one kind or another. And they were distributing them at every opportunity, sports events, music concerts. There, in the early 70s, there was a tremendous amount of enthusiasm in getting out these obscure self-published or, you know, published by a small circle of people or so. So the odds are that Gary Johnson is not necessarily lying when he says it was a book. He's probably a little fuzzy from thinking about something that happened 40 years ago. And it probably wasn't a book. It was probably a pamphlet of some kind, and it was probably self-published. So I can't really comment on that one way or the other. I couldn't find any indication of anything like that existing. So, but I would have loved to have gone and found that and read it and see exactly what he was talking about. But anyway, then Gary Johnson goes on to say that everything starts with the premise of, and this is a direct quote, he says, everything starts with the premise of, well, how does this affect my personal freedom? And I'm not going to say that's wrong. I'm going to say that sounds very Randish. And by that I mean, you know, Rand seemed to, it seemed like for her the whole world circled around her and what she wanted. And there's a lot of tendencies towards that among libertarians. And that's not where I'm coming from. My, you know, if I just wanted everything for myself, and if I just wanted liberty for myself, and I only cared about how things affected me, then I wouldn't be speaking to this mic. I wouldn't be, you know, I would just, well, okay. But many libertarians go in that direction, and I don't really, I'm not going to attack the Randians or that way of thinking. I'm perfectly comfortable in having the Randians among us as libertarians. So, you know, Gary Johnson later in the interview actually references Rand and then indicates that he's afraid to even bring her up because he doesn't want to give his words the wrong answer. So, okay, so then Bob asks him, and the next question was... are there any specific libertarians who have influenced you over the years since you read that book? And I kind of got the impression when Bob asked that question that he was sort of fishing for Gary Johnson to say Rand because his answer was very Randian. And I kind of got the impression that Bob was offering him the chance to say, well, yeah, you know, Rand, this book of Rand or that book of Rand or whatever. But he didn't say that. He gave a very odd answer. His answer was Milton Friedman. Now, keep in mind, Bob asked him, he said, are there any specific libertarians who have influenced you over the years since you read that book? He asked him for specific libertarians. And so Gary Johnson answered Milton Friedman, the Cato Institute, and the Reason Foundation. Now, more than once in this interview, actually I think about three times, if I recall, Bob asked Gary Johnson a question using the word specifically in reference to authors. And each time that he asked Gary Johnson that question using the word specifically, Gary Johnson avoided being specific and was intentionally very, very vague or dodging his question altogether. So he says, Milton Friedman, the Cato Institute, and the Reason Foundation. And so Bob rephrases the question and says, can you remember anything specific that you took away from Milton Friedman? Now, at this point, I want to play the audio from that section just so that you get an idea of what exactly, how the flow of this of this interview was leading. Hold on 1 second. Let's hear this clip here.
Yeah. Can you remember anything specific that you took away from Milton Friedman, from the things he said or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, school choice, you know, that was Milton Friedman. Legalizing drugs, that was Milton Friedman. The whole notion of taxation, and let's not tax ourselves. Let's not tax our income. Milton Friedman talked about changing the world, changing government overnight by simply not allowing the government to make withholdings from your payroll check. That you and I, as employees, we would get the full amount of money that we earned, and then we would have to turn around and write checks to the government. And the point is that we wouldn't put up with it. Gosh, we don't get paid $300 a week.
Yeah, Gary, I'll tell you,
$500 a week.
Yeah, Gary, I'll tell you, there's probably a lot of people jumping up and down who are listening to this right now, and they want me to ask you specifically about Milton Friedman, because I don't know if you're aware of this, but he's the guy that designed the withholding tax. Okay, he in part with hardcore libertarians, he's considered, you know, edgy. The way hardcore libertarians look at Milton Friedman is that where he's bad on issues is where he tends to pontificate a lot, and where he's good on issues, on freedom issues, he doesn't really discuss as much. For example, his monetary theory is a very aggregate Keynesian type. As a matter of fact, Paul Krugman in his recent book pointed out several times in the book how Keynesian Milton Friedman was. And as far as the withholding tax, I mean, that's a real, real problem for the hardcore libertarians, because he designed it, Gary. He's not a guy you would really want to use as far as that's concerned. But
holy cow, what are we going to do with this? Where do you even start on something like that? That's really painful. I mean, it's painful to hear that. Okay, let me start in this direction. The last time that I recommended someone go and check something out at the Cato Institute, actually, I was having a long, drawn-out, months-long conversation with a very conservative, right-wing Republican, and he was being very honest with me and very inquisitive, and I was attempting to help him understand libertarianism as much as possible. And he asked if there was some place he could go on the internet to understand my argument better. And I thought, well, you know, the Mises Institute is kind of hard to chew sometimes for the entry level individual. And LouRockwell.com, again, is a bit, not only is there some questionable material on LouRockwell.com, some of it that's there is difficult to chew for some, for people on the right, you know. So I thought, okay, well, how about the Cato Institute? That would be, that's kind of, you know, that's kind of like a libertarian version of, you know, bread pudding or something. It's very easily digestible. So I sent this person to the Cato Institute. I said, go over there, check out the Cato Institute, listen to some of their lectures, and you'll get, you know, kind of an idea of what libertarianism is and a practical outworking there. And he made an honest attempt. He went over to the Cato Institute. He downloaded audio files. He read. He made a really serious effort to get a grasp of what it was that they were saying at the Cato Institute. And he came back after some time and he said, I don't understand. What's the difference between the Cato Institute and the Heritage Foundation? And I went back and reviewed the Cato Institute and started reading through there. And then I went over to the Heritage Foundation and I came to the conclusion that there's very little difference between the hard right-wing pro-war Heritage Foundation and the supposedly libertarian Cato Institute. I mean, there are some differences, but the significant difference is their position on the Iraq War. And this is, you know, I've said this before, when you're talking about libertarianism, if you start with the premise that libertarianism is liberal on some things and conservative on other things, if you start with that premise, you are wrong. If you say that to other people, you are wrong. If you believe that, you are wrong. If you promote that as a way of describing libertarianism, you are promoting a lie that does not help libertarianism. I've done an entire article on this, and if I can recall, if I can remember to do it, I'll put a link to it in the show notes for today's podcast. But you see, when you tell a person on the right that libertarian is a little bit liberal and a little bit conservative, they're not impressed by that. All they think you are is somebody who doesn't have their head on straight. You have some kind of a weird blend of policies that don't make any sense to the right-wing person. And if you say the same thing to the person on the left, if you say, well, a libertarian is a little bit liberal and a little bit conservative, then they just think you're an idiot. They don't think, oh, really? Tell me more. If they say that to you, it's because they want to pick apart what you're saying and make a fool out of you. The problem with the left, everything that the people on the left believe, is based on a series of premises that they hold. And unless you go after that premise, then you're not going to convince them of anything. And the same way with people on the right. They are on the right because of certain premises that they believe. And those, both the right and the left, are based on fallacies. Libertarianism is not based on some liberal stuff and some conservative stuff. If you think you can describe libertarianism by saying, well, on policy A, libertarianism is like this, this, and this, and on policy B, libertarianism is like this, this, and this, then you miss the point of libertarianism. Libertarianism is not even about how does this affect me. That's not even libertarianism. That's Randianism. Libertarianism is based on the zero aggression principle. The zero aggression principle is the measurement that we use to judge things. So if someone brings me a policy or a law or whatever and says, how does this match up to libertarianism? I don't want to look at what the result of the law may be. I want to look at the morality of, is this based on the zero aggression principle, or does this violate the zero aggression principle? And that tells me if it's libertarian or not. So then, I'll give an example. A classic example is a few years back, and it pops up every now and then, but a few years back, a lot of libertarian-leaning people got really excited because there was this policy that people were talking about, or that they were pushing, rather, of doing drug testing for everyone who receives welfare payments. Everyone who receives welfare payments, or everyone who receives unemployment, or anyone who receives any kind of essentially free money from the government, in the words of the people who were pushing it at the time, if you receive free money from the government, you should have a drug test. And so as soon as I saw that, I thought, libertarians are behind this? This is crazy. Because what is the root? Is the root to slow down or to stop people from abusing public money? Is that the problem? Because to create a whole new bureaucracy to do drug tests on an entire division of people, that's not libertarian. That's not shrinking government. That's not heading in the right direction as far as less government or a smaller government or a weaker government or a more libertarian. What you're doing is you're inflicting more taxation upon people to pay for an entire new bureaucracy to be formed. That's not libertarian. So you don't look for the results you want and say, oh, this will produce, this will make, you know, people not abuse welfare and buy their evil drugs. No, you can't. That's opposite of libertarian thinking. You can't manipulate people's behavior like that. You can't pass laws to restrict people's behavior and expect them to react in the way that you exactly want them to react. That's what Bastiat was talking about. That's the whole point. This is the honest people thinking they can use the violence of government to accomplish good. It's backwards thinking. It's not libertarianism. All right, so let me get back here to the interview. I know what I was talking about there. Sorry. The Cato Institute. Well, what you find at the Cato Institute mostly is their recommendations to government on how to use the aggression of government in ways to accomplish libertarian goals. And so we're going right back to Selene's Law number 3. You're attempting to get politicians, honest politicians, to adjust policies and make laws to accomplish the goals that you want. And you hope that that's going to produce a good, a good end result from that. So after looking through the Cato Institute and then looking through the Heritage Foundation, I decided that I was never, ever going to recommend the Cato Institute to anyone, especially a right-wing person, to try to understand what libertarian is, because I'm not sure they have a good grasp on it over there. I think they're so polluted with being so close in the beltway of Washington, D.C., that they've taken their eyes off the goal, if they ever had their eyes on the goal. Now, Gary Johnson says Milton Friedman was, drug legalization, that was Milton Friedman, and school choice, that was Milton Friedman, and then he goes way off the off the tracks there talking about taxation, and Bob sets him straight to a certain extent. Bob was really polite to him, but, Milton Friedman is the guy who invented the system of the government forcibly taking money out of your pocket before you even see your paycheck. That was Milton Friedman's major accomplishment in life. And so to accredit him with wanting to stop the very process that he sold to government is... Okay, so let's get to his other things. First off, Milton Friedman embraced the concept of legalizing drugs primarily for economic reasons. Milton Friedman was not an idiot. He was a very smart man. However, he was not a libertarian, and he was not Austrian in his economics. He was very much a Keynesian, as Bob points out there. Milton Friedman recognized, through using Keynesian economics, that a black market in marijuana specifically is a horrible idea. It's going to absorb way more money than you can ever justify from the return. He's looking at the argument on a strictly economic basis, and he can see very clearly that this black market won't work. Well, that is one approach to looking at drugs. And then, Friedman, if you actually listen to him talking and read what he said, he sort of reversed engineered. He first came up with a conclusion that a prohibition on drugs was a bad thing economically and it couldn't be accomplished. And then he sort of backward engineered it and started talking about how it was a violation of your freedom and your liberty, and how if a person wants to kill themselves, who are you to tell them they can't do that? Who are you to tell them, you know, that they can't take drugs and destroy their own body or whatever? So he sort of reverse engineered a somewhat libertarian position on that one topic. But again, libertarianism can't be defined by pulling up one policy after the other and saying, where do you stand on this policy? Where do you stand on that policy? You'll never get a grasp of libertarianism, and you'll never show someone what libertarianism is by taking that path. All you're going to do is appear to be very muddled, which is exactly what Gary Johnson appears to be in this interview. But now let's go to the thing that is, you know, sort of the signature of Milton Friedman, and that is the school choice argument. School choice. I'll try to remember to put a link on today's podcast on badquaker.com to the Friedman Foundation's page on school choice. So we don't have to, like, assume what maybe Friedman talked about or what maybe he believed. Go to the Friedman Foundation, use the link on badquaker.com, go to over there, read the front part of that page itself, and you'll see what I'm talking about when I say what I'm about to say. Milton Friedman claimed to support the free market. They always do. People like that always claim to support the free market, but then they define the free market the way that they want to define it. They don't actually, it can't actually be free. We have to still maintain controls on it. Like, for instance, Milton Friedman, he claims he wants a free market, and yet his monetary policies were squarely Keynesian. He wanted, central control of the means of production. So he can claim that he's a free market economist, and he can claim that he wants a free market. But if money is not a free market money, you don't have a free market. Well, the same thing goes with his so-called school choice. Think of it like a McDonald's. Let's say you go into a McDonald's, and you could substitute any particular fast food restaurant for this. I'm just picking on McDonald's because they're the big, easy target. They're the low-hanging fruit. But let's just say you go into a McDonald's. You walk into a McDonald's and you look up at their menu, and you can choose a Big Mac. You can choose a quarter pounder. You can choose a quarter pounder with cheese. You can probably, I haven't been in a McDonald's for a while. And plus they just have a standard hamburger, and you can get that with cheese. You're probably going to find a wide variety of sandwiches that you can buy at McDonald's. You can buy fries there. You can buy chicken McNuggets. You can get an apple pie. You can get all these different things at McDonald's. You have a choice of all the different things on the menu. But the problem with that is that you can't walk into McDonald's and you can't say, I would like a steak, medium rare, with a baked potato on the side, and some broccoli, lightly steamed broccoli with a white sauce. You can't do that at McDonald's. That is not your choice. Now, McDonald's is sort of an aspect of a free market. It's not entirely a free market. But here's the thing about the McDonald's. You see, when you walk into the McDonald's and you look at the menu, and you look up there and you say, you know, I really don't want French fries that have been soaked in corn syrup before they were flash frozen and then trucked over here to be deep fried and handed to me. I don't want that. And you look at the picture of the Big Mac up there and you think, you know, that stuff they call meat inside there doesn't look like or taste like actual beef. So I don't want that. I really am not even comfortable feeding that to my dogs. And you look at their other choices and you say, McNuggets, what exactly is that? It's made out of some kind of weird meat glue and I don't want that. Well, thinking of school choice the way the Friedman Foundation pushes school choice is like being there in McDonald's and looking at that menu and saying, okay, these are the things that are offered to me, but If you don't want them and you think, well, you know what, I think I'm just going to go ahead and go someplace else, and you start to leave, well, imagine that Ronald McDonald is standing there with about 50 of his cloned clowns, and they're all armed. And when you start to leave, you hear rounds being chambered in shotguns, and you look around, and there's an army of clowns around you, all of them armed, and all of them with their guns pointed right at you. And they say, no, you can't leave. This is it. Now make a choice. Choose off that menu. And you're like, I don't want this stuff. This is garbage. I don't want to eat this. I want a choice. And they point the shotgun right up at your forehead, and they say, you have a choice. Pick from the menu. That's Milton Friedman's school choice. You can't have a school choice the way Milton Friedman pushed it unless you choose off the menu that the government provides. You can have this school that the government approves of, or you can have this other school that the government approves of, and we're going to rob you whether you use either of those schools or not. And we're going to rob the little old lady that lives down the street who's never had a child. We're going to rob her, and we're going to make her pay for it, whether she ever uses that school or not. That's freedom of choice in the world of people like Milton Friedman. That's going to McDonald's and having them shove a shotgun right up in your face and say, you have a choice. Would you like a Big Mac, or would you like a Quarter Pounder? Or would you like a Quarter Pounder with cheese? Do you want French fries with that? And that's your choice. That's what the government provides. In Milton Friedman's world, if you say, you know, I think here's my choice. I think I don't want to pay taxes to support everybody else's schools, and I don't want my children to go to school of any kind. I want to take my children with me to work. I want to show them how I do my job. I want to let them explore nature and let them explore life in general. You can't do that. That's not on the menu. But I thought you said we had school choice. It's not on the menu. Folks, I'm going to break because I'm starting to get a little irritated. I'm going to break for a commercial. I'll be right back in about 2 minutes. Thanks. How would you like to support BadQuaker.com and get something nice for yourself at the same time? I want to tell you about Survival Gear Bags. It's run by my friend Kelly, who believes in and adheres to the non-aggression principle. Kelly's customers know him for his great customer service and his personal touch, because Kelly handles all customer service himself. The main focus of Survival Gear Bags is to allow you to build your own custom emergency kits with quality gear. Now, I know this because I bought my bug out bag from Survival Gear Bags over 2 years ago, and I've gone all over the country with it by my side. And you can rest assured that the prices will always be the best they can be at Survival Gear Bags. And if you use the link from BadQuaker.com, they'll probably throw in something for free for you with your order. Now, how do you do this? Well, it's simple. You go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side of the page, click on the picture of the backpack. Then look around at Survival Gear Bags and find the stuff you want. You'll help BadQuaker.com, and you'll support a merchant that's one of us. Now, I want to tell you about another way you can support BadQuaker.com and get something really cool at the same time. Shire Silver. Shire Silver is the proud seller of silver and gold trade cards. Shire Silver believes that silver and gold trade cards will show the world a better way to save, spend, and share precious metals. So what are silver and gold trade cards? There are specific weights of gold and silver laminated inside credit card-sized tradable cards. They're a handy and affordable way to trade precious metals. These cards received nationwide recognition when they were widely used as barter at the New Hampshire Porcupine Festival. You want a beer and a hot dog? Hand them a Shire Silver 5 card and get a Shire Silver 1 spot back as change. So again, what do? Well, you go to BadQuaker.com. On the right side, just below the backpack, you'll see the Shire Silver trade cards. Click on those cards and then check out Shire Silver's site. Be sure and watch Ron's video that's right there on the main page, and then swap some of those ridiculous Federal Reserve notes for something of real value, something you can keep, trade, or give as the coolest gift ever. But be sure and use the link from badquaker.com. Thanks, folks. All right, back from the commercial. Thanks for sitting through that, and let's jump back into this here, and I'll try to maintain my anger. And let me just say, in defense of Gary Johnson, it's not necessary for every libertarian to know every aspect of Austrian business theory, or even be able to say it. Austrian business cycle theory, it's not absolutely necessary that every libertarian understands these things, and it's not absolutely necessary that every libertarian takes the exact perfect libertarian view of every single issue. Not only is it not necessary, it's not possible. But what we do need to get straight, if we're going to put ourselves out in the public and we're going to present ourselves as a libertarian, then you need to have some kind of foundational understanding of what libertarianism is. And, going back to the Cato Institute, they actually do, over at the Cato Institute, they have like a Hayek Memorial Hall that they do most of their meetings in and so forth like this. And so, if you actually check out Hayek a little bit, and keeping in mind my favorite quote in reference to Hayek is Hans Hermann Hoppe saying that Hayek was a muddlehead. But, he was. But Hayek still had some foundational understanding of economics and was directly in opposition to people like Friedman on many of the major issues that that Friedman was strongest on. And like Bob points out in this interview, Friedman has a tendency on the things that he's very, very wrong about, that's the things that he's most vocal about. And on the things that Friedman was right about, he sort of brushes across them and doesn't really make a big deal out of them. So he's entirely backwards in his thinking to begin with. So I need to move on, otherwise I'm going to start yelling about McDonald's again. The next question that Bob asks is, he says, have you read a lot along the lines of the Austrian theory that's generally promoted by the Mises Institute? And to give you the setting of this question, let me play the audio from that segment of it. And you'll notice right when this starts, Bob asks Gary Johnson about the Mises Institute. And what struck me the moment that I heard this the very first time, with my wife sitting across the desk from me, and she was hearing it for the first time as well, the insincerity of Gary Johnson when he responds to whether or not he's familiar with the Mises Institute was really striking. The falseness, the typical politician nature of his answer struck both my wife and I. We weren't looking at each other. I was looking at my monitor. She was looking at her monitor. And we both stopped, and I had to bend my head to the side for us both to look at each other because we were both stunned by the shallowness of Gary Johnson's answer. And what I instantly thought of was a Pink Floyd song where it portrays in the song they're speaking to a music producer or some big shot in the music industry, and they come in front of this guy and he says, the band is really fantastic, that is really what I think. Oh, by the way, which one's Pink? Indicating in the song that the music industry person had no idea who they were or what their music was like, knew nothing about them, but yet says, the band is really fantastic, that is really what I think. And then, by the way, which one's Pink? Well, none of them is Pink. Pink Floyd is not a person. And if the music producer had known anything about the band, he would have known that. But clearly, his shallow answer indicated he knew nothing about the band. And that's the impression I get when Gary Johnson answered. Let me just play it for you and see what you think.
Okay. Are you familiar at all with the Mises Institute?
I am, yes.
Well, what are your thoughts? What do you think of the product they put out?
Oh, I think it's terrific. I really think it's terrific.
Okay. Have you read a lot along the lines of the Austrian theory that is really generally promoted by the Mises Institute, say, have you read any of Murray Rothbard's works?
Yes, and I would just, like I say, I would just be in agreement with the notion of economic cycle, and that recessions are a good thing, a healthy thing, and if depressions actually come about, that being the same, and the Federal Reserve manipulation of interest rates, the softening of recession or depression.
What do you think causes the a recession? I mean, what is your view on that?
What causes a recession? Just the notion that we all get overheated a little bit, and we spend a little bit too much, and then we have to rail it in because we don't have as much money as we, or can't consume as much as we think we can. And again, just
okay, Gary,
the natural cycle.
Yeah. Okay, Gary, I got to tell you, you know, at this point, anybody that's a hardcore libertarian is listening to this interview and they're saying, you know, Gary does not even understand the basis of the Austrian business cycle theory. Okay. Are you with me there?
No, I'm
Gary.
Not.
Okay. Basically, the way the Austrians look at it, the way Murray Rothbard would look at it, the way Ludwig von Mises would look at it, the way Ron Paul would look at it, what they see is the Federal Reserve printing money and actually causing the business cycle, which causes the boom and the bust. And they see the Federal Reserve as a problem because of that. And they see the business cycle coming about because of that, and that without the Federal Reserve manipulation of money, there would be no business cycle, okay?
Yeah, I told you that was painful, didn't I? Now, you notice also, right in the beginning, he asks, Bob Wenzel asks Gary Johnson if he has read Murray Rothbard, and Gary strongly says yes, that he has, indicates he's familiar with him and has read him. And that's a little bit of a problem. After this clip ends, and I didn't play it just because of length of time here, but after it ends, Gary Johnson makes some really lame, the standard Keynesian statements about tulips and business cycles before the Federal Reserve, and Bob refutes him and gives some basic information where a person can look up that kind of information, and you know, that's a really weak argument. That's like telling an anarchist, well, without the government, who would build the roads? It's that kind of a weak thing that a person throws at an Austrian if they have no idea what Austrian economics is and they have no knowledge of you know, economics at all. They say something like that. They throw tulips and business cycles and before the Federal Reserve. What, and this is maybe just a little brag on my part, what really shocked me was that Bob says, basically he indicates that he has not read Murray Rothbard's History of Money and Banking in the United States. And that's, that really shocked me. I would have thought Bob had read that. Bob Wenzel is very well founded in his economics. And maybe he just has no interest in reading, you know, boring histories of money and banking in the United States, like Murray's book, but I read that years ago, and really enjoyed it. I really liked I'll put a link to where you can get that at the Mises Institute. It's a really good book. You can get it in PDF form. You can buy it as a book. You can, somewhere over there, there's an audio of it. I can't remember who did the audio, but it's probably either Jeff Riggenbach or Floyd Lilly. I think it was Jeff Riggenbach that did the audio on that. You know, that may have been Jock Coates, too. I'm not sure. If you don't have the time to sit down and read something like that, search around a little bit on Mises, find the audio version, and, you know, listen to it while you're doing gardening or, you know, working on a car or whatever it is you do in your spare time. Just plug it in and listen to it. It's pretty good. Anyway, so all that's beside the point. I'm going to play the third clip now so that you can really see you can see Gary Johnson and how blatantly he lied in this.
If I said that I read Murray Rothbard earlier, I have not read Murray Rothbard.
Okay.
And I apologize
I'm just trying to understand, you know, how where you are in the spectrum as far as libertarianism. What about Ludwig von Mises? What would be a favorite there?
Well, I have just read excerpts from von Mises. Bob, if you're out to catch me, you've got me. I mean, you know, you got me. Hook, line, sinker.
Yeah, well, Gary, I'm just trying to understand.
I'm not sure.
Yeah, let me just ask you one more, because I'm just trying to get you, find out on the spectrum of libertarian. I mean, you're running as a Libertarian Party candidate, so I'm trying to understand where on the spectrum of libertarianism you are. What about Henry Hazlitt? Do you have a favorite of one of his books?
You know, if I could just point out that the ACLU, is this a group when it comes to civil liberties that you would respect?
Some of their positions, absolutely, yes.
Well, so the ACLU came out with a report card on all the presidential candidates. Did you happen to see that one?
No, I did not see that, no.
Well, they came out with a report card on all the presidential candidates. 24 Liberty Torches was a perfect score. Rick Santorum and Mitt Romney had 0 Liberty Torches out of 24. Newt Gingrich had 4 Liberty Torches out of 24. President Obama had 16 Liberty Torches out of 24. Ron Paul had 18 Liberty Torches out of 24. And I had 21 out of 24. So, Henry Hazlitt. No, I haven't read Henry Hazlitt. I have not.
Yeah, that was, that, like I said, that starts out with a blatant, with him admitting that he lied. He first says, he strongly says that he had read Rothbard, and then he admits he had not. And then clearly he doesn't know who Hazlitt was. And so rather than answering the question directly, he wanders off into a long dialogue about how he's the better of, you know, he's the lesser of evils. He's better than the other devils that we have to vote for, you know, because you have to vote. What kind of a citizen are you if you're not voting, right? Anyway, so, this is so painful. I really thought Gary Johnson had his act together better than this. But, you know, first let me address the lie. First off, if you're going to go, like I said how many times in this podcast so far, if you're going to go on, if you're going to be interviewed by someone who has, who is specifically an economist and has, their own blog on economics, and they've spoke to the Federal Reserve, and this is the whole focus of what they do, and they're going to interview you, you probably ought to know something about economics before you go on there and take them on. Second, if you don't, just say, I don't know anything about that, and just be honest about it. Don't attempt to be, you know, knowledgeable about something you know nothing about. The falsity of that just shines through, and you know, people are not that dumb. People see through these simple political tricks like that. Well, I should say, not everyone sees through it. Obviously, the guy is the libertarian candidate. So not everybody is seeing through these thin falsehoods and these. Yeah, no, he's lying. He lied. So, you know, when you portray yourself as something that you're not, even if you don't technically lie, if you're portraying yourself as something that you're not, you're still lying. This is why I'm so particular about. Whenever possible, I do not speak in absolutes. I try to, like if I plan to go to the store tomorrow, then I don't say, I am going to the store tomorrow. I'll say, I plan on going to the store tomorrow, or I hope to try to go to the store tomorrow. I'll say something in a vague way, so because I don't control the future. I don't control what may or may not happen tomorrow. So I try not to speak in absolutes. And the reason why is because my attachment to honesty and the truth is so great that I don't want to put myself in a position where I've deceived anyone. And, you know, truth is so valuable. I'm going to go off the topic entirely. I need to get back to Gary Johnson. Now, the problem that I was talking about there with the Libertarian Party and why it's rotten on the inside and why the entire libertarian movement is threatened by this is it's based on the same fallacy that Rothbard himself, it was Rothbard's greatest error was this idea that you can embrace people on the right or embrace people on the left and use the political means, use the parties to try to advance libertarianism. The very core of that concept is flawed, and in my opinion, like I just said, it was Murray Rothbard's greatest mistake. The idea that he could use, Mises, when Mises first came to the U.S., fleeing the Nazis and coming to the U.S., he was in a position where he had to take money from questionable organizations just to stay alive and in order to maintain themselves, he and his wife to maintain themselves. And throughout Mises' life, through odd circumstances, people financially supported Mises who were honestly, at times, people financially supported Mises who were exactly the opposite philosophically of what Mises was saying. And so Murray was kind of schooled in that, and when Murray came into his maturity, unfortunately Murray did the same or tried to do the same thing, and this caused the fiasco with the Cato Institute at the founding of the Cato Institute, where Murray attempted to use hardline Republican money and the Koch family, their influences. He tried to use that for good, to try to establish the Cato Institute and try to develop something that would promote libertarian goals. And the result was this poisonous thing that came back to bite Murray in many ways. And it's important for us to learn this lesson. You know, the Libertarian Party, the last presidential election, Bob Barr was their man. He was essentially a right-wing hater, a CIA insider, not a right-wing hater as in he hated the right wing. He was a hater from the right wing, a CIA insider, and the Libertarian Party embraced him. And now you've got Gary Johnson, who, in many ways is the left-leaning side of that same formula. This is what represents libertarianism to most people, because it's the libertarian. It has the label, the Libertarian Party. So when they see this, they're confused by it, and they think that that's what libertarian is. When in fact, libertarianism is this simple: it's the zero aggression principle, property rights, liberty. It's that simple. It really is. Except when you take that and you try to marry it into government to accomplish what you want by using the violence of government, then you've abandoned the very principle that you're based on. So, that flaw, that is the internal rot that is so prevalent in the libertarian movement, that is so damaging and will eventually bring its death. I'd like to go into that more. I'm out of time. So let me just say, using the government to fix the government won't work. Marches won't work. Petitions won't work. Voting does not work. Adjusting the laws won't work. Legal tricks won't work in the long run. They may work temporarily. A real popular thing right now is to say to a policeman, am I free to go? Am I being detained? Am I free to go? And you keep repeating that until he lets you go. That works right now to a certain extent, but it won't always, because the state figures these things out and adjusts itself. And the state cheats. And people who support the state, they themselves will cheat and lie, because that's what the state is based on. And if we think that we can use that aggression and that cheating and lying to make things better, then we're lying to ourselves. That's all we're doing. Folks, for more on liberty, the zero aggression principle, and property rights, go to badquaker.com, and thank you very much for listening today.